6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called for an investigation into an airstrike on a school in Syria that killed nearly 30 people, most of them children. Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says warplanes carried out 6 strikes on a village in rebel-held Idlib and hit a school complex. Both the observatory and the U.S. have said either the Syrian government or the Russian governments were responsible for the attack. Meantime, Russia's ambassador to the U.N. says he is unconvinced by a report linking the Syrian government to the use of chemical weapons in at least 3 instances. Vitaly Churkin says the report lacks sufficient testimony, material proof, and was full of contradictions, yet he offered a reserved level of praise for the investigators.
They were given an extremely difficult task to investigate things which happened 2 years ago without even visiting the sites which were involved. They did their best, I suppose.
An inspection team under the joint offices of the UN and the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has issued a report on the incidents. The U.S., the U.K., and France want the UN Security Council to impose sanctions on the Syrian government for using chemical weapons. Ethiopian troops have been fighting Al-Shabaab militants in Somalia, have vacated a series of military bases, sparking fears of a militant resurgence and a possible setback for African Union efforts to stabilize the country. The troop withdrawal comes at a vulnerable time as the government is organizing elections throughout November and the UN mission AMISOM is on the defensive following a string of high-profile Al-Shabaab attacks. This is VOA News. India has expelled a staffer of the Pakistani High Commission in New Delhi, accusing him of running a spy racket that accessed sensitive information about Indian security operations. Islamabad rejected the allegation, saying the man had been detained on what they called false and unsubstantiated charges. The expulsion comes as relations between the two countries have hit a low following a militant attack last month on an Indian army camp in Kashmir that left 20 soldiers dead. A former U.S. First Lady running for president, Democrat Hillary Clinton, shared the campaign stage for the first time with the current First Lady, Michelle Obama, during a campaign stop in the U.S. state of North Carolina. Mrs. Obama spoke to rumors that Clinton and the Obamas are not as friendly as they have contended.
Yes, Hillary Clinton is my friend. She has been a friend to me and Barack and Malia and Sasha, and Bill and Chelsea have been embracing and supportive from the very day my husband took the oath of office.
Hillary Clinton spoke about being in Winston-Salem, North Carolina once before with a notable African-American poet and civil rights advocate.
I will never forget visiting here with the legendary Maya Angelou, one of the most powerful voices our country has ever heard. So I couldn't think of a better place to come back to with another woman whose voice we need now more than ever.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump campaigned in the state of Ohio.
If we win on November 8th, Okay, you ready? When we win, there's a lot of good energy in Ohio, that I can tell.
The Eau Claire Politics, which compiles voter survey averages, shows Clinton leading Trump 46% to 40%. The election is November the 8th. Korean automakers Hyundai and Kia reached a settlement with 33 U.S. states and Washington, D.C. on charges that inflated the fuel economy numbers of 2011 to 2013 models. The company will pay $41.2 million in fines. They've already paid out $300 million to the U.S. federal government and compensated some car owners. Get more news at our website. You can find us at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, October 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South African President Jacob Zuma has stopped the release of a corruption report.
I interdicted it because he was going to issue a report, having not talked to me or asked me questions.
Burundi's foreign minister says there is no comparison between the political crisis in the DRC and the crisis in Burundi. On exploded landmines in parts of South Sudan pose a threat to civilians. And Cameroon's opposition party has called for an independent investigation into last week's train wreck that killed 80 people and wounded 800 more.
We had written and called for an independent commission to be set up both at the civil side and also to have the parliamentary group come up with some investigations.
John Frundi is leader of Cameroon's largest opposition party, the Social Democratic Front. We'll tell you about a woman in northern Nigeria who is working to give girls an education. And we'll also take you to a boarding school in Kano, Nigeria, where they are trying to save children who lost parents to Boko Haram. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South African President Jacob Zuma is leaving no stone unturned to try to stop the release of a report that implicates him in alleged corruption. From Johannesburg, Tuso Kumalo updates us on this latest chapter in a series of corruption scandals during the past year that have eroded support for Mr. Zuma and his African National Congress party.
In a series of corruption scandals during the past year that have eroded support for Zuma and his party, the ANC, 2 weeks ago, President Zuma halted the release of a report from South Africa's new anti-corruption chief, Tuli Madonsela. Zuma interdicted the report on October 13th, just a day before it was due to be released. At the time, Zuma said he acted so the report would present his side of the story.
I interdicted it because he was going to issue a report, having not talked to me or asked me questions.
In his latest affidavit to the courts, Zuma questions why he is portrayed in one of the affidavits as an implicated person instead of as a subject of investigation. He also argues former public protector Tuli Madonsela, who produced the report, made him believe he will be given an opportunity to respond to the allegations, but that did not happen. In its current form, the report is likely to prove embarrassing to the South African president. It is said to contain allegations linking Zuma to the powerful Gupta family and showing the Gupta's huge influence inside the Zuma administration. According to local media who were leaked elements of the report, Deputy Finance Minister Mcebisi Jonas told investigators he was offered millions of dollars by the Guptas to take over former Finance Minister Nhlanhla's position and promote the family's business interest. Former ANC Member of Parliament Fakie Mento has also said she was promised a cabinet post by the Gupta family, and that is also part of the report.
The claims about the Guptas have also attached to them claims regarding their proximity to the president and the president's son.
Eyes are now on the courts to decide if the report will be released or not. If released, it could be so damaging that Zuma could be left with no option but to step down. But not releasing the report is causing controversy within Zuma's party. Mento is one of party members concerned.
If a president is, for instance, directly or indirectly implicated, I'm sure the president can take leave.
The court is set to hear Zuma's application Tuesday. Opposition parties have vowed to use every legal avenue to make sure the report is released. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The foreign minister of Burundi says there is no comparison between the political crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo and the crisis in Burundi. Alain Yamitwe says President Pierre Nkurunziza was re-elected in an election that was recognized by Burundians and never questioned by any regional court. Mr. Nkurunziza was re-elected last July to a controversial third term that the opposition said violated the constitution and the Arusha agreement. Since then, there have been disappearances and killings by unidentified groups. In the DRC, President Joseph Kabila and a smaller group of opposition coalition agreed this month to postpone elections until next year. Aline Yamitwe says Central African leaders who met this week in Angola's capital, Luanda, endorsed the DRC agreement and encouraged the parties to address their grievances through non-violent means.
The head of state and government congratulated the Congolese stakeholders who have reached an agreement and encouraged them to go for peaceful elections, which they have scheduled for 2018. And of course, the summit has asked all the Congolese to refrain from violent means in addressing their grievances. And that is exactly the same which was recommended to all member states in the region. Wherever there might be some differences, they have encouraged dialogue and peaceful means. That includes my country, Burundi, as well.
Did the heads of state take into consideration the fact that the situation in the DRC is between the government, President Joseph Kabila, and a small group of opposition parties, excluding perhaps what some say is the main opposition?
Yes, because the facilitator, Mr. Edem Kojo, made a report that the agreement which was reached on the 18th of October was still open. It's Article 24, if I'm not mistaken. It clearly indicates that those who want to join the agreement can still do so and participate in the institutions will be formed in the run-up to the electoral period. They take into consideration the fact that some groups in the opposition who did not accept the agreement. So it is a complex situation where you have to make sure that the country still runs, that the institutions still function properly, and also you have an opportunity to the people of DRC to choose their own leaders. And I believe that having the elections in that time frame will be reasonable enough. Now, as a region, we urge all the Congolese people to abide by the agreement and to use peaceful means whenever they feel like demonstrating or they feel like expressing their own opinions concerning the political situation and voting in the country.
Mr. Minister, does Burundi see a parallel between what is happening in the DRC, the political crisis in the DRC, and your own situation? Because in a sense, the opposition in the DRC is claiming that President Joseph Kabila is trying to sideline the constitution by staying in power. That's the same allegation that was made against your president.
I guess there's no comparison, James. First of all, it is absolutely now established that President Nkurunziza ran a formal and an accepted electoral process. His bid to run for the seat of president was accepted by the court, and it was not questioned by any court in the region, and therefore there's no question about that. And it's been more than a year that President Nkurunziza has been sworn in as the president, so there's no longer an issue. As far as President Kabila is concerned, I believe that as we speak today, there's no such an issue in DRC. The constitution of that country clearly stipulates that in case there's no election, the incumbent president continues to run the country until new elections are held. We are in that situation as we speak. Opposition has its own right to speak out their minds, but I do not believe that whatever they say is necessarily true. Not to say that what they are saying is absolutely false, but I do not want to get into that debate because, first of all, it's an issue of Congolese people themselves. It is up to them to find solutions to their own situations.
Where are we in the dialogue process in your country between your government and the opposition?
First of all, let me inform you, James, that during the summit, the Tanzanian delegation clearly indicated that the process dialogue was a positive one, and that President was doing, you know, something, you know, great. And I think that the summit has also praised his work and commended his efforts. As we speak, we are expecting a new invitation for another session. I will not know when that will take place, but hopefully in the next 2 weeks, we'll get that invitation and we'll take it from there.
Aline Yamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the Angolan capital, Luanda. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, October 28th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Cameroon's President Paul Biya has constituted a commission to investigate the cause of last week's train accident that killed at least 80 people and injured about 600. But John Frundi, leader of the biggest opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, says the commission is unlikely to be effective in determining the cause of the derailment. He has called for an independent panel to investigate the train accident. In this interview with VOA's Peter Clotty, Mr. Frundi accused President Biya of leaving out opposition members from commissions he constitutes to investigate national issues, including the recent train derailment.
We had written and called for an independent commission to be set up both at the civil side and also to have the parliamentary group come up with some investigations. But Mr. Biya, as usual, went ahead single-handedly to choose his own members of the group of the team investigating the cause of the derailment and the somersault of coaches that so many people died. Because if they come up with a figure of 80, they are coming up with the figure of those that they saw their names on the list. But when it was announced that the road between Yaoundé and Douala had collapsed, so many people went to the train station and they added coaches and just told people to get on board and they'll be issuing tickets and collecting money from them as the train moved on. So when they say 80 people, I think Cameroonians hold it that more than 80 people died. About 200-300 people must have died.
You called for an investigation from Parliament as well as an independent investigation. In Parliament, the majority of parliamentarians are members of the ruling party. So how independent can that be?
Mr. Biya up to now knows that his people only go in to embezzle and tell him what he wants to hear. So if you were an objective person, he could have gotten people outside the circle of friends that he always chooses.
So who are you calling on now? The president has the mandate and given the mandate by the constitution to protect every Cameroonian. So he forms a commission that he feels is capable of investigating this. What is your problem with that?
My problem is that in all the commissions he set, he's always put people that have never told him the truth because he believes that because he's had the false majority in parliament, he invited me, for instance, once to go to come to Yaoundé for us to discuss about the senatorial elections. I had an accident on the road. As I was entering the prime minister's office, they were announcing that this is what they've done. So all these investigations that is set up in Cameroon and he keeps choosing his people who do not come out with the truth. I think for once, if he had the interest of Cameroonians at heart, he would say, please hold on a bit, and he'll try to. Can he not tell me that? Can you give me 2-3 people for this commission? Or Frundi, I want you to handle these investigations and let Cameroonians know what actually happened.
But Mr. Frundi, why do you think he needs to give the opposition leader who has been criticizing for all intents and purposes anything at all? Cameroonians reposed confidence in him. They elected him to lead the country, so he has the sole responsibility to set up a committee to investigate. Why?
He is doing it in the interest of Cameroonian people. It's not in the interest of Frundi.
He has already set up an investigative team or commission to inquire about this accident. You don't think the commission he set up or established is competent? Why?
Because all the commissions is always set, none. If you want to put anything in Cameroon to sleep, you set up a commission and it goes to sleep.
If that is the case, then what you are suggesting of an independent investigation will also go to sleep because it's Cameroon.
Right. That he should put neutral, objective people, and we still have some of them.
And the neutral, objective people are the only people who are in the opposition and not the people that he chooses?
No. There are some of them who are not in the opposition, sir. I beg your pardon.
But he has the prerogative to choose any Cameroonian he feels is competent to investigate this.
Now that he's chosen, let's give him the benefit of doubt. And tomorrow he'll call me to tell me that I was right. Let us see what report he'll come up with.
John Frundi is the leader of Cameroon's biggest opposition party, the Social Democratic Front. He spoke with Peter Clotty from Boué in Cameroon. The United Nations Mine Action Service in South Sudan says they increased the number of unexploded ordnance in the former Central Equatorial State and other parts of South Sudan poses a major threat to civilians. Warring parties planted landmines in recent months. Some residents affected by last July's fighting in Juba have suspended work on their farms because they are afraid of stepping on a landmine. Michael Atit has the story from Juba.
The United Nations Mine Action Service, known by the acronym UNMAS, produced a map last month showing more than 600 explosive hazards in former Central Equatoria, Eastern Equatoria, and Jonglei states. UNMAS program officer in South Sudan, Kelly McCauley, says her team has very little access to locations due to ongoing fighting.
The Equatorias and Jonglei are, as far as we know, the states which are most heavily impacted by explosive hazards. So what the map shows us, the contamination we know of and we are aware of. But I think once access increases, especially to the north of the country, the map is likely to change quite dramatically. But in terms of what we know, the area around Juba is very heavily impacted. It's very heavily contaminated.
McCauley says many children and young men have been injured by landmines. She says between July last year and June this year, 57 people have been killed and 21 others injured by unexploded ordnances in South Sudan. The landmine expert says the figure could be higher because most areas affected by fighting are inaccessible to humanitarian aid workers.
The big impact that mines on UXO have in South Sudan is that they stop the local population from accessing things or services that they really desperately need. So that could be water. And sometimes this can be a strategic target for people who are laying either mines or UXO to put these hazards in or close to water sources.
McCauley says women remain at high risk because they are exposed to mine on a daily basis as they look for water and firewood.
And in Bentiu, what we saw was that women had to walk much further to get to the nearest water source. And we know that women are very vulnerable to all sorts of attacks, sexual violence, gender-based violence within country. So the longer these women and girls have to walk from their homestead, the more they're at risk.
Lucy Anur is the headmistress of Green Hill Primary School in Gudele residential area in Juba, which was one of the battleground during July's violence. She says the pupils had to stay away from the school until UNMAS officials determined that the school compound was free of mines.
They managed to reach our school and they surveyed our school for 2 weeks because the compound is too large. When they completed on the 18th, our children immediately report to the school.
McCauley urges both sides, which signed the 2015 agreement, to implement the accord so that agencies like UNMAS can go about their work in South Sudan.
We obviously hope that peace will come soon in South Sudan so that we can get on with this very critical work. But currently, a lot of our teams are not achieving full productivity because we can't get to the areas most in need.
Last month, UNHCR reported that thousands of South Sudanese who sought refuge in neighboring countries are afraid to return home because they fear the existence of landmines and other unexploded ordnances in their villages. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
In northern Nigeria, children brave violence every day just to get to school, and the average girl stops attending class at the age of 9. But one woman is working to give Nigeria's girls the chance to get a quality education. Rabia Eshak is the Jigawa State Commissioner for Education, Science and Technology. She says if African countries want to spur innovation and economic growth, they must equip young people with the skills to unlock their potential. Heidi Fitzpatrick has the story.
Nigeria has more children out of school than any other place in the world. The United Nations estimates that more than 10 million Nigerian children are not receiving a formal education. Rabia Eshak says she has seen firsthand how girls have been disappearing from the classroom.
Poverty is a very grinding, a factor that stops girls from going to school because they have to be used for labor. And sometimes also girls, get married early and they don't get to go to school. We all know about the Chibok girls that were taken away from schools, and that was a demotivator for many girls to go to school, for many parents to send their kids to school, especially in the insurgency-ravaged areas.
It wasn't until she sent her own daughter to school that Eshak noticed something equally worrying.
Even the few girls that actually get to school, they don't get the quality education that I got. When I saw that my girl was not learning, I knew that then other girls were not learning. And of course, other boys too. But I felt that if the indices show that, you know, less and less girls are coming out of school, then I believe that there is something wrong and that something needs to be done.
Eshak began working to improve the standard of education in northern Nigeria. She established two schools and set up five campuses of a polytechnic institute to teach young people, especially girls, the skills they needed to become self-employed when they grow up.
I started a project that targeted girls only, which I call the Girls Advancement Project. And I worked in very rural communities with young girls who weren't in school at all, but who needed to learn to read, write, and some basic skills, some basic life skills.
Eshak led the largest education project in Africa, reaching about 18 million Nigerians and inspiring the government to fund the renovation of hundreds of schools. Her story is featured in a new book about women creating positive change around the world. Eshak says it's vital that education is treated as a development priority across Africa.
That was Haiti Fitzpatrick reporting from Nigeria.
Boko Haram's insurgency in Nigeria has victimized thousands of people, but none have felt as much pain as the children who have lost both parents to the terror group. A boarding school in the northeastern Nigeria state of Borno was established a year ago to help these children and now has 100 students. VOA's Hausa Service reporter Barajit Bashir visited the school and filed this report narrated by Salim Solomon.
The Borno Orphan Boarding School was built by the Kano and Borno state governments for one purpose, saving children who have lost everything. The 100 students here are between the ages of 5 and 8, except for one student who is 13. All of them lost their parents, killed by the Boko Haram insurgency, and were forced to flee their villages. Each child carries a heartbreaking story, but they are now living a fairly normal life. Saidu Goza had this to say about the orphanage.
I have no problem with the food or the well-being of myself and other students. The officials are trying their best. I enjoy studying and living in the orphanage.
The school has a big compound, a playground, dormitory, and a library that a non-government organization recently donated. Some children are already dreaming of a life beyond the orphanage.
I want to become a doctor so that I can help the less privileged and the needy.
Sometimes teachers have to overcome a language barrier to educate the students.
At first, I usually get a student that understands very little of the Hausa language. But then I tell him what I want to explain and have him explain it to the rest of the children, and steadily I begin communicating with the orphans. It was not easy, but with determination and dedication, I'm able to communicate and teach them.
Despite the positive outlook, challenges remain, especially about the lack of support staff. There are few staff members looking after the children and additional employees are needed. School officials hope the government will recruit more staff in the near future. Salim Solomon for Baraje Bashir, VOA News.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A man was shot dead outside the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi after attempting to attack a paramilitary guard outside the building on Thursday. The embassy confirmed that no American personnel were involved. That's it for this Friday, October 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty, along with our engineer Zubair El Tayeb, I'm James Butte, wishing you a very good weekend.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the electoral process and presidential elections in the United States. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Next on Let's Talk, they say most people in the world have no idea how to manage their money. Do you? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing money management. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.